parcel of Krishna. So this is called Who Am I? The spiritual science based on the teachings. Is that focused all right? Should I try and get it a little better focused? All right. All right. At some point, we must have all asked ourselves the question, who am I? What am I doing here? Where did I come from? Where am I going? And if we've answered in this way, it's been superficial. If we've been answering as I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a businessman, I'm a designer, I'm a sportsman, I'm a musician, husband or wife, father or son, American, Japanese, Chinese, Christian, Muslim, Hindu. And then this is within India. You know, it's always a funny thing to me that when you have a room full of Indians who don't know each other, the first question you always ask is, like, what part of India are you from? Because they immediately want to come behold you. Punjabi, Bihari, Assami, Gujarati, Bengali, Kannada. They want to know what part of India you're from. And these are some of the different designations within India itself. You have Gujarati, Bengali, Delhiite, Punjabi, and so on and so forth. All these designations are temporary designations based on the body. We think of ourselves as male or female, young or old. We identify ourselves by our land of birth, by our occupation, and our belief system. But the problem is that all these change. They're not stable. They're not permanent. You know, we could call ourselves a boy at one stage, and then 15 years later, we don't call ourselves a boy anymore. We say I'm a man. And so, but we're still the same person. Throughout life, no matter what type of a body you have, whether it's a young body or a middle-aged body or an old body, we always say, I am young, I am middle-aged, I am old. So the object always changes because it's referring to the body. But the subject never changes because it's referring to I. So I don't change, but this body changes. So therefore, I should not refer to myself as this body because I'm equating an eternal entity with a temporary one. And so it's a mismatch. If we just think about it also in terms of normal grammar, why do we say my nose, my ears, my hand, my shirt? Why do we say my? If I'm this body, why don't I say I body, I hand, I head, I chest, I shirt, I legs? But we don't say it that way. We say my. So who is the possessor? Who is that entity that possesses the body? It's not the head. It's not. And so we play this game, you know. Point to your head. Point to your hand. Point to your thigh. Point to your back. Point to your ear. Point to yourself. And that's a little more difficult to do. A lot of people actually point here, which shows some accuracy because it's described in the Vedic literature that the soul is within the region of the heart. It's 1/10,000 the size of a tip of a hair. And yet it's so powerful that it infuses the whole body from the top of the head to the tip of the toe with consciousness. And the blood comes out of the area of the heart being revived and recharged and vitalized by the presence of the soul within the heart. So David Hume, and these are kinds of things that you can figure out just by introspection. I mean, you don't necessarily need scriptural authority. David Hume, he asked the question, what's the difference between the seer and the seen? You know, the eyes are there in the body of the corpse as well as in the body of the live person. But when the body of the corpse is there, there's no seer. There's no seer. So it means the eyes are not the seer. The body is not the seer. But it's something that's seen through the eyes. So the eyes are not seen, but they're just windows through which the soul sees. So he asked the difference. What's the difference between the seer and the seen? Seer is eternal, and the seen, you might say seen also, S-C-E-N-E, the seen is also always changing. So if you identify yourself with this body, this is what you're identifying yourself with. These are the chemical components of an average body. And when we list them all and we add up their value, it's not going to be very much. You're made up, your body, not you. I slipped up there. Your body is made up of enough lime and fat to make 7 soap bars. I could only make 3, I think. Enough phosphorus to make 20 matchboxes. Enough water, there's 90% water, enough water to fill a 10-gallon tank. A little sulfur, calcium, and other trace elements. The body is made up of enough iron to make 6 small nails, enough carbon to make 900 pencils, enough sugar to sweeten 10 cups of coffee, and enough potassium to fire a Tory cannon. So you add up the value of all those chemicals, the calcium, the iron, the phosphorus, the water, and you get $20. So if you say, I'm American, I'm black, I'm white, I'm Visman, you're saying, I'm basically worth $20. So why should anyone cry when you die? Why should anyone cry? It's just, I mean, one time my wife, when we were living in Culver City, she got $20 to go over to the hardware store to buy something. And what she did was, she had the $20 in her hand, and she was, I don't know what she was doing. She described it to me. She had her hands on the counter with the $20 under it, and then she turned to look at something, and then when she went back, it was gone. So she came back, she told me the story, just, you know, okay, take another $20. It was no big deal. I mean, it certainly didn't ruin our day or anything like that. So why should there be so much lamentation when a body dies? Why should that be the case? Why are these people wailing and grieving over the loss of $20? You know what I'm saying? Here's a wreck on the freeway. There's a $50,000 BMW that's just been smashed by a semi-trailer. And it was a $20 worth of person who got killed inside. So you'd think that if we were this body, you'd cry more over the BMW, wouldn't you? I mean, the BMW is worth $50,000. The body's worth $20. If there's a wreck, a BMW, and someone's killed inside the BMW, wouldn't you think you'd cry more for the BMW than for the person? Wouldn't the BMW be more valuable? It certainly is physically. It's worth $50,000. The body's worth $20. But that's not the case. We actually cry for the human being. It's not because of the body, but it's because of the eternal soul. Body's always changing. See this little house here. Imagine all the bricks. Imagine every day in that house, you replace one brick every day. After 7 to 10 years, it wouldn't be the same house. It would have the same shape, but it just wouldn't be the same house. Every single brick would have changed. So similarly, 100% of all the cells of our body die and are replaced every 7 to 10 years. So if you live 80 years, you'll have basically had 10 or 12 totally different bodies. They may resemble each other, but the elements of the body, the constituents of the body, are totally different. So here's where Lord Krishna really starts his teaching. In the Bhagavad Gita, there are 18 chapters, 700 verses. And after setting the scene, the first chapter is called Setting the Scene, he really begins to explain the spiritual philosophy in the second chapter. And right in the beginning of the second chapter, he says, as the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth and into old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at the time of death. And here's our famous graphic of the changing bodies, showing youth and old age and childhood. Every single tour, this is practically speaking the best part of the tour. It's the thought that gets people thinking the most. When I bring people before this picture at the top of the stairs, I ask them 2 questions. I did it today to the Landmark kids. And the first question I say, is this one person or many different people? They all get it right. They say it's one person. Next question. Is it one body or many different bodies? That question most people get wrong. Because they're thinking it's one person, they have a tendency to say it's one body. Even though it's obviously not one body. It's one person in many different bodies. But they all have a tendency to say, one person, one body. But that's not the case. That's not the case. The body changes. And in fact, today's body is not the same body you had yesterday. Tomorrow's body will not be exactly the same body you had today. So we're reincarnating even now. Even as we sit here, we're reincarnating. Karno refers to the flesh. Re means changing. Reincarnation means our bodies are changing. And they're doing that all the time. It's not that after 7 years you're thinking, oh my gosh, it's been 7 years, it's about time to change bodies. You know, and there's a body hanging on a hook there, so you get out of this one and you put that one on. It's happening every minute of every day, every hour, for 7 years, and then it will have completed its circulation. But we're still the same person. I have a body like this now. 40 years ago, I had a body like this. For all practical purposes, this body is dead and gone. But something's present in this body that was present in that body. It's not the physical. It's not the mental. If we change our physical body every 7 to 10 years, if we change our physical body once every 7 to 10 years, how many times during that period do we change our minds? Like thousands of times, you see. So the physical body, according to other verses in the Bhagavad Gita, is compared to a coat made of earth, air, fire, water, and ether. And then the mental body is compared to a shirt, the body of mind, intelligence, and false ego. And then inside is the soul. And the soul is traveling throughout different bodies in this lifetime. The body is changing, but the person remains the same person. There are basically 6 changes that take place, not only with this body, but everything. Even the universe itself undergoes 6 changes. Here's 2 of them. Takes birth. We take birth, the universe takes birth. Next one is growth. We grow, the universe grows. One of the reasons that the scientists believe everything started from a Big Bang is because they've measured the universe is expanding out, which would be consistent with an explosion, but it's also consistent with just the normal life cycle. So those are the first 2, birth and growth, and then these are the last 4. It stays, or duration, probably between the ages of 20 and 40. You're pretty much on a plateau. And then after 40, it starts slowing down. And in the meantime, during that period of maintenance, you produce offspring. You start to raise a family. And then after 60, I once had a friend in California. We used to run on the weekends. I would sell cookies and then run. And he was about 65. And at that time, I was maybe 55. So he said, wait till you get to be 60. He said, it's like falling off of a cliff. He said, you can run and keep fit and sort of maintain yourself. But after 60, I mean, you can slow down the deterioration, but you cannot stop it. You cannot stop it. You cannot. It doesn't matter how much training you do or how much you do. You will not get better. All you can do after 60 is to slow down the process of getting worse. When that happens, you're in the dwindling stage. It's also called the yellow light stage. When you go through an intersection, the light just before red is yellow. So when the signs of old age start coming upon us, it's the warning sign. You better get serious about spiritual life. You better start weaning yourself of attachment to sense objects, because you're not going to be able to stay much longer, and then what you do in this life is going to have consequences for the next life. So everything goes through those 6 changes. What are they again? What are they again? Birth. Growth. Maintenance. Reproduction. Dwindling. And then poof. Poof. Vanishing. Actually, I was thinking, you know, we should ban the word death, because there is really no death. The body just dissipates and the soul goes on. So there's really nothing that actually ever dies. It's kind of an illusion that anything dies. We lose the association of that particular soul. And that can be a sad thing. That can leave us feeling bereft. But we actually should somehow or other figure out how not to use the word death. Because It's not, nothing really dies. Nothing really dies. Everything survives, but it just changes its state. When someone, quote unquote, when their body drops, you could more accurately describe that phenomenon that so and so has taken rebirth. They didn't die. Nothing died. But you can say that when they drop and there's no lower life, you can more accurately say the soul has taken another body. See what I'm saying? Than to say that they've died. And that's what's happening right now. We are all taking new bodies, different bodies, because of the cells changing and being replaced by other ones. So how can we know the presence of the soul by its symptoms? You can't see the soul because we have material eyes, material ears, material nose. You can't perceive something that's spiritual. And in fact, it's the spirit which is supporting the vision, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting. If the spirit wasn't here, then all those things would be null and void anyway. So you can't take the instruments of perception and turn them around to perceive, because they're not the perceivers in the first place. They're just instruments. And when the perceiver is gone from the body, they're of no use whatsoever. So you have to see the soul differently by its symptoms. Just like if someone were to drink this cup of coffee and then drop over dead, then we would know that there had been poison in the cup of coffee because of the symptoms it produced.
Yeah.
So how do we determine the presence of the soul? How do we prove it? Because of the symptoms. The fact is that this body is alive, that we are conscious, and so that in itself is proof of the soul. Because when the soul has left the body, the seeing, the eyes, the nose, the smell, and all is still present, but yet at the same time there's no life present there. Prabhupada used to say, he went to MIT University and he challenged the student body and the professors, what is the difference between a living body and a dead body? And nobody could answer. Because they wanted to answer it on the basis of some electricity or some air or some chemical thing. And Prabhupada said, we'll give you all the chemicals. If you say that this chemical or this electrical impulse is missing from the dead body, we'll give you that, we'll supply that, then you bring it back to life. But that you can't do. That was his challenge. Another example in that connection is that of a cloudy day. You see the dark clouds here. You cannot see the sun. But how do we know the sun is present? Because sunlight is piercing, penetrating the clouds. So because there's sunlight, we know that it had to have proceeded from some source. So therefore, even though we can't see it, we know the sun is there. So we experience consciousness. So where is the consciousness coming from? Even if we can't see the soul, we know consciousness is coming from the soul. So that's the proof of the soul. We hear about it from authorized sources, Srinvatam Shakata Krishna. More here. Just now coming. Can't read that on this screen. What does it say? Oh, okay. By its symptoms. Consciousness, I just mentioned that. It's a symptom of the soul, just like light is a symptom of sun. And along with consciousness, we have the phenomenon of thinking, feeling, willing, and we have awareness. Here's a robot. The robot is going through various motions, but the robot has no experience of what is going on outside it. It may be moving and seeing and speaking and memorizing and responding. We can actually program computers to do these functions, but you cannot program a computer to have emotions, to feel that it's experienced something, to have desires, and to experience consciousness. This is a video camera. Which one is it? Okay. This is a person. This is a person who is observing these other people, these judges and juries. The observer is conscious, able to judge, experience, and... Oh, I see what it is. These are judges. They're going to sit down. They're going to hear a court case. They're going to make decisions. They're going to be conscious of what's going on, and they're going to experience it. Now this camera records everything. It hears and it sees everything that the judges hear and see. But because there's no consciousness there, it will not be able to make a decision, and it has no feeling of experiencing the trial which is going on in the courtroom. Just like a machine can say, I see red light, but does the machine actually experience seeing the red light? Then another verse, again, in the second chapter. That which pervades the entire body, you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy the imperishable soul. Wherever you see the presence of consciousness, the soul is there. And people say, well, animals have no soul, and that's the biggest justification for eating them. If you acknowledge that the animals have a soul like we do, then you wouldn't be comfortable eating. Most people eat animals, don't even give a single thought about the suffering and the pain and the torture that the animal went through. In fact, our veterinarian, he was a veterinarian, he just retired, John Hunter. He took care of horses and cows and all of our llamas for 40 years. He told me one time, down there in the parking lot, animals don't feel pain. I said, John, how can you say that? How can you say that? I mean, they scream, they bleed, they try to avoid. Why do they try to avoid pain? Why do animals get really nervous when you take them to the vet in the waiting room? Yeah, and if they've been to the vet before, and they know the only time you get them in the car is you're going to the vet, and they won't get into the car. Why is that? If they don't feel pain, what difference would it make to them if they didn't feel pain? I mean, you know, all the things that I do, I avoid pain. If it comes to me, I scream, I bleed. The animals do the same things. And I don't know what the difference is. You can say that the animal doesn't feel pain, and I do. I just don't know how you can say what the difference is. Or that the animal has no soul, and I have a soul. I'm eating, and the animal's eating. See that? He's eating, and the tiger is also eating. We are sleeping, and what is it? Cow, right? Is that focused? Well, we're eating. Is that better? And the animal, we're eating, and the animal's eating. We're sleeping, the animal's sleeping. We're mating, and the animals are mating. We're defending, and the animals are defending. Prabhupada said the animals are mating simply. They're fighting with tooth and claw. They're sleeping under a tree, and they're eating whatever is freely available. But we're fighting with atomic weapons, and we're mating with waterbeds and all kinds of mood music and all. But what have we done? We've simply taken those four animal propensities of eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and we've polished them. So modern society, which emphasizes comforts in the course of eating, sleeping, mating, defending, is just a polished animal society. The difference between the animals and the human being is that the human beings can ask, who am I? And why am I here? One argument that someone gave to Prabhupada, why they ate animals, he thought he had the answer to this question, what's the difference between us and the animals? And he said, we understand metaphysics. So this was his argument, that now we could kill animals because that's the big difference between us and animals. We understand metaphysics. And Prabhupada said, what does physics mean? Means this body. And what is meta? It means above this body. So if you understand metaphysics, you understand that above this body is the soul. And the same soul is in the presence of the animals. So then if you actually understand metaphysics, it would mean that you would take care of the animals instead of that you would kill them and destroy them. That's what metaphysics means. More in the Bhagavad Gita. The body appears to be alive, but that is due to the presence of the soul. Sometimes I'll go to a classroom, and I'll say, is this body alive? And everyone say, yeah, your body's alive. And then I'll say that. Okay, now I'm doing jumping jacks, okay? Now I'll say, is this shirt alive? And they'll say, no, the shirt is not alive. But it appears alive, doesn't it? Because it's moving, so on and so forth. Actually, everybody knows the shirt is not alive. I can take the shirt off, throw it on the ground, and it won't do anything. So we know the shirt is not alive. Similarly, the body is also not alive. It's not alive. It only appears to be alive because the soul is inside it. Just like the shirt only appears to be alive because I'm jumping up and down and the shirt happens to be on my body. That gives it the appearance of being alive. But we know, intellectually, that if you take it off, then it'll be revealed for what it actually is, an inert element. So similarly, this body may appear to be alive because of the presence of the soul, but actually, it's not any more alive than the shirt is alive. So here you do the comparison, the analogy that the driver of the body is like the soul and the car itself. The body itself is like a car. Now here's Mahatma Gandhi. Look what he did. Look what he did. I mean, when his soul was in his body. I mean, he's 85 pounds soaking wet. He's not movie star handsome. He's not a big scholar. He didn't have any PhDs. He didn't have any money. He's got this scrawny little body, which nobody in the wildest stretch of their imagination would call strong or good looking. And yet, look at what he did. Look at what he did. Not the body, but the determination, the leadership qualities, the humility, and the strength that was in the soul. He defeated the most powerful nation on the world. He defeated. They said the sun never sets on the British Empire. And of all the British possessions, India was their most prized possession. They would give up everything else before they'd give up India. The British just loved to go to India and be the white colonial lords and have all the Indians serve them, be in Delhi and like Bangalore. They loved it. They loved everything about India. Britain had a love affair with India. And the last, they could give away every other one of their colonies. But even Churchill said, we'll never give up India. So this, as long as his soul was in the body, this man defeated the greatest power the world has ever known. And now, what is he capable of doing? Once his soul left the body, once he was assassinated, what was he capable of doing? What speeches was he capable of giving? What movements was he capable of leading? What big powers was he capable of kidding out? Now the chemicals are the same. There's no difference between this body and the body I showed you before. The chemicals are exactly the same. But he ain't even going to be able to eat a kachori. And the one previous defeated the most powerful nation in the world. So what was the difference? Same chemicals, everything. The difference was, of course, the theme of this talk, which was the soul. That body had feelings of injustice. Why should the British take advantage of us? Why should they exploit us? That body had feelings of injustice. This body doesn't feel this. He doesn't feel that anymore. In this state, there's no more feelings of injustice, you see. There are no more desires. In the previous body, he had a strong desire for freedom. He had a strong desire to throw off the colonial yoke. He doesn't have any such, there's no such body desire anymore that pertains to this body. No thinking, no strategizing, no thinking of ways to stump the British or to trick them or to get rid of them now, and no movement, you see. No marching to the sea, no quit, no speeches, no movement, nothing. So the only difference really is that particle of self or soul that was in the body. It's the same body, but something's coming up here. Whoa, the soul is gone. So here's our cycle of birth and renewal. I was actually happy the other day. I heard, I was somewhere, and instead of hearing the interminable and interminably repeated Christmas songs, you know, about this time of year you think, if I hear Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer one more time, I'm going to go postal, you know. I'm just going to go postal. Well, I was walking somewhere, I don't know where it's Best Buy or something, and just, actually, and there's a certain point when you reach saturation, you know. And I was feeling that. And then all of a sudden, I heard, should old acquaintance be forgotten? Well, how does that go? For old acquaintance. And I was like, oh man, yeah, that's great, you know, that's great. So this is the, you know, after death, there's renewal. In fact, you might say death is just a door that you walk through. It's so temporary. It's so temporary. It's just a door that you walk through. We give it far too much credence because it doesn't occupy, but really just a split second. There's a point in the present body when you're too old or you're too decrepit, where the pain level basically gets intolerable. We've all experienced pain, but it hasn't been intolerable, and the proof of that is we're still here. There's a point far beyond anything we've experienced thus far in this life, where the pain, you might be young and you might get hit by a truck, which means you all of a sudden got old. Or it might come in 90 years or so. But there's a point that just all the aches and pains and everything just add up, and you just vacate. That's all you do. You know, if you're living in an apartment and the crane comes by with a big ball and starts smashing your windows and walls, what do? You get out. So when the body just starts decomposing, when it starts demolishing, you get out, and it's just a doorway, and you walk through the doorway, and you've got a new body. You've got a totally new body. It's like getting rid of an old car and getting a new one. Of course, Krishna consciousness is meant to get not another material body, but a spiritual body, our original spiritual body, which is eternal. Because for us, for our spiritual selves, there is neither birth nor death at any time. Najayate maniyate kadachin. The soul has not come into being. He does not come into being. He will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So I tell the kids, I said, if you look at the changing bodies diagram and you look down here at the old and the decrepit body, I say, would you really want to keep that body? Imagine you had a car with 400,000 miles on it. You take it, you know, in Utah, you're required to have annual inspection and emissions. And only if you pass, then you get a renewal of your license plate. You know, what would it cost to get a 400,000-mile car renewal inspection? It would cost thousands of dollars. It'd be cheaper just to go ahead and buy a new car. You'd be cheaper to get buy a new car. So the point is that when this body is old and useless, we relinquish it and we get a new one. It's just as simple as that. And what type of a body we get in the next life, how is that determined? What's the principle that determines what type of a body we get in the next life? Our actions in this life. If we're going to get another material body, it's by karma. It's action and reaction in the material sphere. You do good, you get a good result. You do bad, you get a bad result. You do good, you become a demigod. You do bad, you might have to take birth as a subhuman. So according to our karma, we get a bad, maybe less than human body, or a human body, or a superhuman body. But if we act in a spiritual way, if our highest and most consuming desire is to serve God, to use our senses for singing God's glories, for discussing His pastimes, for cooking nice dishes that we're offering to Him, for sewing and clothing Him, then our conscience becomes spiritualized, we have spiritual desires, and then we get a spiritual body as the outcome of those desires. If we live like an animal, and we've all heard the term party animal, and there's a lot of people that live up to that, then we get exactly what we want. We have a license plate that says party animal, and we can't wait for the weekend. So that's what you get. Your body in your next life is just exactly what an extension of your activities in this life. You see what I'm saying? Or if you're very good and you're very pious, you donate in charity, you do good works, and you help old ladies across the street, and then you do good works, and then you get a good body, a pious, righteous body, whereby you can live on the heavenly planets. But the problem with good and bad karma is those are all material bodies. They're gross material bodies, and they're subtle material bodies. But they're all material bodies. And so from each of those, you have to die and then return to the middle ground, earth planet. So the difference between acting according to the law of karma and acting in devotional service is called akarma. And in Sanskrit, when you want to negate something, you put an A in front of it. So when you want to negate both good and bad of this material world, you serve Krishna in love and devotion. And that negates both good and bad karma. So that one doesn't generate another material body, but one generates a spiritual body for serving the Lord. So after this life, there's four different options. There's down, there's back as a human, there's up from the material point of view, and then you might say there's out. There's out of this material world. And those who go out never come back. Some look on the soul as amazing. Some describe him as amazing. Some hear him as amazing. While others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. So how's that? That was about 35 minutes. Is that good? Wind it up, part one. Maybe do part two next week. Is that okay? Do you have any questions or comments?